Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Boy, that was interesting, wasn't it? Greece riots, Wall Street reacts. Just another day in the life, I suppose. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Nixon Peabody LLP, a full-service international law firm offering practical solutions for today's real-world business challenges. More at nixonpeabody.com. And by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 6th of May, and it is good to have you with us. I don't mind telling you, gang, that for about 15 minutes today, right around 3 o'clock New York time, there was a little voice in the back of my head saying, oh man, here we go again. In less time than it's going to take us to tell you the story, the Dow Industrials dropped 700 points, off 998 from the open, before what you can only call an amazing rally, the stock market equivalent, really, of a bungee jump. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson is on the line from New York to help us understand what the heck happened. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Kai.
Obvious cause of this whole thing was Greece. Vivid television pictures of the riots over there, over their economic problems. But it does kind of smell a little bit like there's some fear in the markets, no?
It sure does. It reminded me of those days back in the fall of 2008 in the financial crisis when you'd look out on TV and the Dow was down 50 points and the next thing you know, it's down 500 points. It was kind of amazing to watch today. The Dow was, you know, down a few hundred, then 600, 700, 800, 900, and before you know it, it was right back up. So, yes, fear was definitely played a part in this. It doesn't help, as you said, to have the police and riot gear on television next to the stock market. It's a bit scary. But underneath all this, there are worries about the credit markets. So one bond trader I spoke with today said even as the Dow rebounded, the corporate bond market did not. He says that means that there really are fundamental problems there. Lending, he says, is the tightest it's been since last July. And a lot of bond traders would rather sit on the sidelines as this crisis plays out.
What I hear you saying, Jeremy, is that there are real fears about contagion and problems in Europe coming over here.
Absolutely. And there's the direct cause there. You've got Greece and these other countries, Spain and Portugal, that there are worries over and their trade with us. And the idea that if they're going to dip into a double dip recession, obviously that's going to affect U.S. companies. The other thing is how this is affecting the European banking system and whether European banks will stop lending to each other the same way that U.S. banks stopped lending to each other during the financial crisis here.
Take this apart for me in terms of the mechanics of what happened on Wall Street today. There is electronic trading. There are algorithms that these guys use to judge certain market factors. And that really is what explains this unbelievable drop and then the incredible rebound.
Right. There are some rumors going around now that maybe there was a mistyping by some trader at a bank and all of a sudden shares of Procter & Gamble were sold. But what happens, regardless of whether that was the case, is that when the market falls by that much, a lot of machines are triggered to sell. And it makes the problem that much worse that fast. It is high frequency trading at its finest, or perhaps at its worst. Now, one other thing, Kai, as the Dow fell so fast, there was some question about whether the market would close because of the circuit breakers at the New York Stock Exchange. But it turns out, because it happened after 2:30 p.m., it would have had to fall by more than 2,000 points for the market to close. And, of course, it didn't even reach a 1,000-point drop at any point.
Okay, so here's where you earn your money. What's going to happen tomorrow at the open?
Well, I would love to be able to answer that. I could probably make a lot more money doing something else if I knew. But I think what was so surprising about what happened today is that the market has been really on a steady climb for the past several months until this week. So there was obviously some pent-up fear. And the question of what's going to happen going forward with that fear, just a little push from Europe and investors start selling. Now, one investor I spoke with today said, stand by for a bumpy trading day tomorrow. He says all eyes are going to be on Europe again for the vote on the bailout package for Greece, a vote that is expected to be very close.
And don't forget the British elections and also job numbers here tomorrow morning. Jeremy Hobson at the Marketplace New York Bureau. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks, Kai.
Well, you heard Jeremy say it. As amazing as that drop on the Dow was today, we weren't even close to the point where trading would have been stopped. We will have the details. And, yeah, it's going to be the sad music when we do the numbers. Once we get past the craziness that was the stock market today, we would do well to look at an actual economic indicator that came out this morning. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says we are working hard, America. Productivity was up more than 3% in the first quarter. The same number of workers cranking out more widgets is a pretty simple way to think about that. And in theory, it could mean some green shoots in the labor market as employers try to keep up that level of production. But those shoots are going to grow pretty slowly, as Marketplace's Eve Troeh reports.
When the economy sheds jobs, those left at work have to pick up the slack. That's tough on employers, too. Michael Denny owns American Wine Distributors in San Francisco. He's still reeling from the end of 2008, when he let go five of his 22 workers. He hears things are picking up, but he's cautious. He doesn't want to hire and fire again.
We still have a world of economic troubles out there, and I don't think that the stimulus is really doing anything for the average Joe.
Yet Denny admits things are looking a little better. He's booked a few orders, and he's considering one new hire.
We're putting together a job description, and if the deals that look like they're supposed to come through do, in fact, come through, we're thinking about hiring somebody by the end of the summer.
The workers he has now are pretty stretched. Denny says last year was a no-vacation year. Julia Coronado is an economist at the global bank PNB Paribas. She says employers can't push their staff endlessly.
They reach a limit as to how much they can get out of their existing workforce, and they actually need to start hiring.
Coronado thinks we're at that tipping point. Employers are testing the waters with temporary workers to meet any rise in demand.
And then they convert them into permanent workers as the recovery looks more and more sustainable.
She says it'll be several more months before those jobs are posted. We need a longer period of steady economic growth to soothe employers' frazzled nerves. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
The Senate is working its way through a long, long list of amendments to the 1,400-page financial reform bill. It's going to be another couple of weeks before the thing is wrapped up, and longer than that before it's matched up with the House version. But amendments are where it's at if you want to get some idea of what the final bill is going to look like. So our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is on the line to talk about how the bill is shaping up. Hello, John.
Hello, Kai.
All right, so hit the high points for me. What are some of the big amendments coming up on this bill?
Well, some of these are getting pretty populist. There's one to limit how big banks can get. This is aimed at the six biggest banks, the ones that we've been hearing about, Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. There's also a proposal to reinstate that wall that used to separate traditional banks from investment banks and the other financial institutions that trade stocks and bonds. There's growing support for an amendment to subject the Federal Reserve to an outside audit. There's also a proposal to cap ATM fees and maybe even credit card interest rates. And the so-called Volcker Rule will get a vote. That would prevent banks from wheeling and dealing in stock trading for their own profit.
Let me back you up just a second. Limiting ATM fees, so you mean the $250 I pay to get 20 bucks out of somebody else's bank, right?
That's right. That's right. The current average fee for people using another bank's ATM is now over $2.50. Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin is proposing that banks not be able to charge more than 50 cents per transaction. He says that it costs banks less than 50 cents a transaction to provide the service.
Well, speaking of protecting consumers, and I guess that falls into that category, what about this Consumer Financial Protection Agency that's in the House bill and has sort of been bounced around in the Senate bill? Where do we stand with that?
Well, Republicans tried this afternoon to put some limits on a consumer agency, to put it under the supervision of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and to restrict its jurisdiction over non-banks, the payday lenders, car loan companies, all the small businesses like doctors and florists that can set up flexible credit arrangements with their customers. But the Democrats want a consumer agency with real teeth, and they voted to keep the current agency, which has more independence, even though it is housed in the Fed.
Speaking of the Fed, John, there is an amendment out there, as you mentioned, to subject the Fed to a government accountability office audit, right?
That's right. Opponents are really worried that this is a way for Congress to put pressure on the Fed to keep interest rates low. That's always a popular thing, especially during election years. But of course, the risk there is that the Fed would be afraid to raise rates when they need to be raised, and we'd have higher inflation.
Remind us of how this amendment came to be. It's all about, you know, the trillions of dollars that the Fed sort of plowed into this economy during the financial crisis.
Right. People like Ron Paul over in the House have been pushing this for several years. But under the current crisis, they want to know who got the money from the TARP, the $2 trillion of money that went to financial service companies. And the Fed has never said who got it. And this audit would reveal that.
Okay, so here's the $64,000 question, John. Which of these amendments might pass and which might not?
Well, you know, there's growing momentum behind pretty much every one of these. It's true that there are a lot of provisions here for liberals to like a lot, but the outrage against Wall Street crosses party lines. That Fed audit, like I said, is sponsored by Ron Paul over in the House, and he's hardly a liberal Democrat. The sponsors of that amendment to limit the size of banks are fond of quoting Alan Greenspan, who said that any bank that's too big to fail is just too big.
Funny how Alan Greenspan keeps coming up, isn't it? John Dimsdale in our Washington Bureau. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Okay, so we're going to do that thing right now that we kind of have to do from time to time. Throw a jargony phrase at you as a way to set up a story. Today, it's net neutrality, the idea that internet service providers shouldn't be allowed to limit certain kinds of web content, that everything that's passing through their data pipes ought to be treated the same way. Last month, a federal appeals court ruled that the Federal Communications Commission does not have the authority to regulate high-speed internet access and so couldn't enforce that idea of net neutrality. Today, the FCC said, oh, yeah, we can, but we're going to be gentle about it. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The FCC was forced to defend its regulatory turf last month. A federal court ruled the agency couldn't keep Comcast from treating different types of online content differently, like slowing down huge video files that clogged Comcast's network. Broadband services have been almost unregulated, but now the FCC says it will treat internet service providers more like phone companies. The FCC oversees phone companies' prices and billing practices. It says it won't go that far with broadband providers.
I think this is a middle ground.
Markham Erickson heads the Open Internet Coalition. It represents consumers and internet companies like Amazon. They say now the FCC will be able to expand broadband access nationwide.
Right now, there is no authority for the FCC to provide high-speed internet access to underserved communities, low-income communities.
Network operators like Verizon and Comcast aren't so happy. They're worried the regulations will get tighter, scaring off investors for new broadband networks. Mike Jude is a telecommunications analyst at Frost & Sullivan.
It would be kind of premature to overregulate because you might actually kill the golden goose here.
FCC commissioners still have to approve the changes, and lobbyists might have a thing or two to say.
You think you've seen a lot of lobbying so far? You haven't seen nothing yet.
That's Ryan Radia of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Radia says the FCC's new authority could also be challenged in court. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's an obvious temptation to put a price tag on disasters, figure out how much the damage from an earthquake or an oil spill is going to cost. The floods this past weekend in Tennessee were no exception. In Nashville alone, the total could come to more than $1 billion. That's a tab that's going to be added up one small business at a time. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports.
In the water around Midway Supply Company, bob bundles of corrugated piping and railroad ties.
Is that all your lumber that's sitting outside?
Floating around, yeah.
Owner Dan Riegel says what wasn't moved to higher ground is now floating away in the Cumberland River, about $500,000 worth. The construction slowdown already forced Riegel to lay off nearly half his workers. But if he can borrow enough money, he says he'll stay afloat.
When the water finally stopped coming up and it started going down, it's like, You can go home and cry, or you can say, okay, I got to make a plan and see if we can fix it. And that's what we're doing.
Regal's foreman has been making the best of a bad situation. He's been in his boat, lassoing the floating 2x4s and corralling them over the lumberyard fence in hopes they'll sink on company property. Other businesses are underwater.
My name is Philip Melton. I'm a restaurant manager. I work with Riverview.
Known for its fried catfish, there could be live catfish in the Riverview restaurant right now. It's still submerged, so Melton is already looking for some source of income for at least a few months.
I've got 3 kids and a mortgage, and fortunately, my wife is still working, and, you know, I got a good, you know, pretty strong. I can, you know, operate a shovel if I have to, and at this point, I'm just looking for work.
Joining Melton out of work could be thousands tied to the economic engine that is Nashville's Gaylord Opryland Hotel and Convention Center. The state's largest hotel was flooded when the Cumberland River topped a nearby levee and will be closed for months. Water also got inside the Grand Ole Opry.
We're talking about a major problem.
George Groon owns Groon Guitars in downtown Nashville. The tourism industry is salvaging what it can of summer bookings. The country music industry is bailing water, too. A warehouse called Nashville Soundcheck stored tour gear and personal instruments for country music artists like Keith Urban and Vince Gill. The entire facility was flooded. Groon says vintage instruments will be destroyed.
If your 1937 Martin D28 is submerged, it's not like you can go out and buy another new one.
But instead of writing a sad country song about losing their favorite guitar, artists have organized a telethon tonight to raise money for people who really have lost it all. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up, the cost-benefit analysis of kids.
Why do people have children if the data suggests they make us less happy? There are two possible answers. People are making mistakes, or there's more to life than happiness.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, you knew it was going to be the wah-wah trombones, right? The Dow Industrials plummeted more than 900 points today before it settled. It wound up at 347 points below where it started. That's 3 2/10%. Finished at 10,520. The NASDAQ dropped 3 4/10%, 82 points. Closed at 2319. The S&P 500 slid 3 3/10%, 38 points. Ended at 1127. All that volatility made Wall Street look a bit like a casino, which may explain why gaming companies were some of the biggest losers in the market today. Las Vegas Sands cashed in 7%. Pinnacle Entertainment plunged 6%. MGM Mirage melted 8% away today. Crude oil futures dropped 3% today, finishing at $77 a barrel. Energy companies followed suit. Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon all slid 3% or more. Financial firms might have been making money from all that trading, but they still bled red. Bank of America tumbled 7%. Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, and JP Morgan each peeled off 4%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for April. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release its monthly consumer credit report. And stop and smell the roses. Really, it's National Public Gardens Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. They're calling it a dome, But what's being lowered down into the Gulf of Mexico today is more like a giant concrete box. It's about 40 feet tall, and if everything goes right, by Sunday or maybe Monday, it's going to be corralling a lot of that leaking oil and piping it to a tanker up on the surface. It's BP's best shot at a short-term technological fix. But meanwhile, the oil keeps leaking. And as it happens, about 70,000 oil and gas industry professionals are gathered this week in Houston for their annual offshore technology conference. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports now from the Sustainability Desk.
Oil spill? If you work in the oil industry, those two little words mean your lips are zipped.
Why don't you want to comment on this?
I think you should contact Transocean or the authority.
This industry executive started turning away as soon as I asked a question. He was one of many who stayed mum about the spill. When I tried to take a photo of, get this, a giant valve, one company's employee practically tackled me. Conference security made me delete the photo from my camera. One person who didn't mind talking was David Doig, CEO of Opito, a company that sets global safety standards for the industry. He foresees choppy waters for offshore drilling in the U.S.
I think it'll be different. I think it'll probably be far more regulated than it's ever before.
In other words, big oil isn't exactly popular. Industry expert John White of Triple Double, a Houston consulting firm, hopes all the attention from lawmakers who plan hearings on Capitol Hill next week doesn't lead to an outright offshore drilling ban.
Reality is behind big oil, there's, we estimate, about 80 to 100,000 jobs for primarily U.S. citizens in the Gulf of Mexico, either directly or in support functions.
That's everything from engineers who work in Houston to drillers, motormen, and roustabouts who live on the rigs. While almost all offshore rigs are assembled in Asia, U.S. companies build this specialized technical equipment that operates on the seabed and below. Rice University researcher Amy Jaffe says all this work has provided an economic cushion for the area.
We are one of the few parts of the country that has not had a terrible economic downturn. And so if we suddenly saw a tremendous amount of technical jobs lost in our economy because we were going to stop our offshore industry,
that would lead to an increased dependence on foreign oil, she says. The U.S. already imports around two-thirds of its oil. As for the remaining third the U.S. produces, a third of that comes from offshore. One conference-goer without a hint of doom and gloom was Merrill Lee. Her company, Kepner Plastics, makes the booms now snaking across the Gulf, helping contain the spill.
We're ordering lots of extra materials and talking about putting a second shift on, so.
So business is good?
Business is booming. I'm sorry.
So to speak.
I had to say that.
In fact, booming business might just be the unintended consequence of a more regulated industry. Take Cameron, for example. The company's been in the headlines because it made the blowout preventer valve that investigators think may have malfunctioned, allowing the spill to spread. Industry experts say more regulations will most likely mean a greater need for safety devices, the kind that companies like Cameron make. In Houston, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
If you have kids, there are probably times when you feel a little overwhelmed. Yeah, you love them and all, but, you know, they're cute. But you look around and you realize you and your spouse don't have enough quality time. You don't get out much anymore for dinner or a movie, much less to the gym. Your life is their life, and you're not quite completely happy. Research actually backs that up. But commentator Betsy Stevenson suggests that maybe we're looking at it the wrong way.
There's an unhappy fact to ponder this Mother's Day. Women with children are less happy than similar women without. The same is true for men. When people hear this fact, they immediately suspect that happiness gains from children must exist somewhere. Aren't people who are religious happier when they have kids? No. Aren't people with kids much happier later in life? No. Is this only true for those in a specific education or income group? Nope and nope. So why do people have children if the data suggests they make us less happy? There are two possible answers. People are making mistakes, or there's more to life than happiness. Perhaps children offer a sense of fulfillment or something else not captured by surveys assessing happiness or even life satisfaction. Understanding what these survey questions capture animates a current debate among researchers. Does self-assessed happiness capture our total well-being, or is there something more? To date, most economists have considered these measures equivalent to total well-being, but there are some pretty forceful critics who think that happiness is just one component of a good life. And because people choose to have children, these critics argue that children must make us better off. It's an old assumption of economists. If I choose it, I like it. However, more recently, psychology-inspired economists have suggested that sometimes we choose things that make us worse off. We make mistakes. So are people making mistakes by having children? How can we answer this question? Psychologists encourage you to look for someone like yourself who is currently experiencing the new life you're contemplating to see how they're feeling. But we know the answer to this question. They're less happy. So perhaps we need to ask a different question. Knowing what you now know, would you still choose to have kids? Most of the people I know give a resounding yes to this question, and that was enough for me. I'll be celebrating my first Mother's Day as a mother this weekend. And if you ask me, I'll tell you that I'd do it all over again.
Betsy Stevenson is an assistant professor of economics at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. You can send us your thoughts, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, working to help small businesses understand what social media can do for them. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out after the day that was on Wall Street. Jeremy touched on this when we talked up at the top, but there is some speculation now that it was a trader at a big bank making a typo that kicked off the crash, trying to sell 16 billion with a B shares of an S&P futures index instead of 16 million with an M. The New York Stock Exchange, for what it's worth, did say there was nothing at all wrong with the trading system on there, and as far as that goes. So stand by for tomorrow, as Jeremy mentioned. That's Marketplace for now, though, from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shaved off 347 points, 3.2%. The NASDAQ off 82 points, 3.4%. The S&P 500 unloaded 38 points, 3.3%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news and the earliest on what's going to be happening on Wall Street. Coming up next time on this program, sleep falls farther down on mom's to-do lists.
I've always read that, you know, you can get an extra hour of productivity by simply getting up earlier. What that does is you just shave off what is actually physiologically required for you.
Yeah, you got that right. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.